Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to episode 125 of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is one of the most popular and increasingly respected movie stars in Hollywood, Ryan Reynolds. The 40-year-old Canadian has been acting since he was just 13, and first burst onto many people's radar as the star of the 2002 comedy Van Wilder. Over the years since, he has starred in movies of all shapes and sizes, from acclaimed indies like 2007's The Nines, 2009's Adventureland, 2010's Buried, 2014's Woman in Gold, and 2015's Mississippi Grind, to studio fare like 2004's Blade Trinity, 2009's X-Men Origins Wolverine, 2009's The Proposal, 2011's The Green Lantern, and, most recently, 2016's Deadpool. That adaptation of a comic book about a most unusual superhero, which Reynolds, as one of its producers, fought for more than a decade to bring to the big screen, had a budget of $58 million, low for a movie of its genre. But upon its release in February, it exploded at the box office, grossing $132 million on its opening weekend, and by the end of its theatrical run, $363 million domestically and $783 million worldwide, making it one of the biggest hits of 2016. And it also garnered rave reviews. In recognition of his performance as Deadpool's irreverent title character, Reynolds received a star on Hollywood's Walk of Fame, the Critics' Choice Award for Entertainer of the Year, and a Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy Golden Globe Award nomination. The film, meanwhile, has been recognized with a Best Picture Musical or Comedy Golden Globe nomination, as well as Producers Guild, Writers Guild, and Directors Guild Award nominations. And on January 24th, it might well show up among the Oscar nominees as well. Over the course of our conversation at the offices of The Hollywood Reporter, Reynolds and I discussed a wide range of topics, among them the odds-defying way in which he landed his first professional acting job back in Canada, the many various obstacles that he faced over the years in bringing Deadpool to the big screen, how he ended up making another comic book movie, The Green Lantern, while simultaneously working to get Deadpool off the ground, how he felt about the box office failure of The Green Lantern and several other films soon after it, and what changes he made to write the direction of his career, and what he's made of the tremendous success, in every sense, of Deadpool, which has landed him firmly on Hollywood's A-list. So, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Ryan, thanks so much for doing this.
Well, thank you for having me.
Of course. We always begin by just asking, where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
I was born in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. My dad was a police officer and then later retired into a sort of nondescript food brokerage job. And then my mom was kind of a career student. She went to university pretty much, still going to university. And she's 71.
Wow.
She's a senior student. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, so I would have, you know, I think a lot of people might assume that based on the way things have worked out, you would have been a confident, you know, kid. But I read some things that suggested maybe there were, you know, it took a while to figure yourself out a little bit. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think most people are figuring themselves out well into their golden years, I think. But yeah, I wasn't a confident kid. No, I was just the opposite. I as a kid and really as an adult, even more so, I always struggled with a bit of anxiety. So as a kid, I really kind of delved within, you know, I would find that as I was, you know, trying to kind of control others in my household by controlling my own behavior, mm-hmm. you know, and I had a dad that was like, you know, his temperament was not unlike a skin-covered landmine. You know, he was a smart guy. He was a tough guy. Yeah. He wasn't like, I don't mean to paint him like he was an abusive guy, but mm-hmm. he was a hard guy. He didn't make things easy for anyone, especially himself. So,
and it was you and a few, so how many siblings?
It was myself and three older brothers, okay. Yeah. So we all kind of had our own weird sort of maladaptive coping mechanisms to get through it all. And everybody turned out great, you know? We got lucky. I think you know, I look back at being a kid and being like, you know, certainly more fortunate than a lot of kids that I knew growing up. But, you know, I had a roof over my head and I had food and all that stuff. But the hardships or the moments that really kind of hurt when you're younger are the moments that build great character when you're older. And I think had I not had those, as much as I bemoaned them in my early 20s looking back at them, then I don't think I'd be where I am now.
Yeah. Speaking of, you know, where you are now, when did acting first enter the picture, even as just a messing around type of thing? What point did that come along?
I did improv comedy in Canada as a kid. I was in a little improv group with some guys from school. And
starting sort of how young?
13.
Wow.
Yeah. And then I ended up, the acting thing was just kind of sort of by accident. I got chosen to do a I didn't get chosen, actually. A television show that was just this really kind of ultra-low-budget teen soap opera came to town. They were doing cattle calls, and anyone could come. But they also asked every high school to find their five best drama students and send them along. And I was not picked, of course, as one of those, but I decided to go anyway.
Yeah.
And luckily, when I got there, they decided to not use script pages. They just wanted to do improvised scenes about things. And I had already been jumping in that arena a little bit, so I was really quite ready. But there were 5,000 kids there. It was this huge swatch of children everywhere. So I thought my chances were a little bit slim, but little did I know, they whittled it down, and I ended up being one of these kids that were chosen. And you sort of think, oh, I've made it. Like, I'm going to be rich.
Yeah.
But they actually paid us about $250 a week. So I kept my paper route. Right. I kept that for a few more years, and that was sort of my first sort of experience with the this showbiz thing, and then ended up working normal jobs, you know, like sort of forklifts and, you know.
But that show, so just to, because people may not realize how long you've been doing this. You were 13 or 14 when you got this.
13.
This is 15. It was sort of a soap opera that was on Nickelodeon, right?
Yeah.
And you were working, it was in Florida, right? So this changed your life in a big way.
Part of it was shot in Florida, yeah. The first season was shot in Ottawa, Canada, which is the other side of Canada, and then it was shot in Florida at Universal Studios, which was such a great thing for a kid like me who just, you know, really, I went to this cattle call in the first place just to get out of the house.
Yeah, yeah.
So it was this great experience where I got to leave home and I got to live with a bunch of other guys in this house with a kind of like sort of house mother, sort of chaperone type situation and, you know, get up to no good, but nothing too crazy, you know.
So how did school and things work? Did it just, were you now out of the school system and privately doing this?
No, God, no. I was still at school. They would shoot these shows in they would shoot something like 20 episodes in a month.
Wow.
So I'd be gone a month and then I would catch up when I got back. And
yeah. I heard that there was sort of a conversation that happened when you were about 17 where, you know, after that show ended, you were doing some TV movies and things, but not especially fulfilled by what you were doing. And was there somebody, like a friend of yours, who you sort of vented to a little bit about this? And
yeah, I had a buddy that I was about to, that was the day before I was going to go to university. It wasn't really university, like it was like a local community college, to be perfectly honest. And I just said, I really don't want to go. And he was like, well, I'm going down to LA. I'm just going to go down to LA and just give this thing a shot. And I said, okay, well, good luck. And I went the next day to university and I quite literally spent 45 minutes there. And I walked in, looked around, went, nope, and rolled back out, got in my crappy Jeep and just drove for 21 hours straight to Los Angeles.
With him or then meeting him there?
Then meeting him there,
wow.
Yeah.
So and you were solo.
Yeah, I parked my car outside the Highland Gardens Hotel and it's still around, I think, in Hollywood, Franklin and Hollywood. And unloaded my bags, came back out, and my crappy Jeep was stolen.
Oh.
Yeah, and I found it four blocks away with no doors on it or anything like that. So it was kind of a nice little...
Welcome to showbiz.
Yeah, fuck you. Yeah. Welcome to LA. Yeah.
So at that point, though, when you were arriving out here and trying to settle in, what was the dream at that point? What did it look like?
Well, I had no expectations. I mean, I was this 17-year-old kid. I had $300, a rape whistle, and a bottle of water. That was kind of it. So I really didn't have much. I just really wanted to join the Groundlings. That was my goal, was to
big
get
improv
Groundlings.
Group.
Yeah, and that's not something that pays money, you know, that you can live off of. So it was a really kind of an ill-thought-out plan.
And with improv, what do you think had drawn you to that since you were 13? Now you wanted to keep doing it out here. I know it didn't work out with the Groundlings, but I mean, comedy's been a thread throughout your whole life. I mean, I think you seem to be a great writer, even just reading your tweets.
Yeah, I like writing, yeah.
Yeah, so was it ever possibly going to go in that direction where you would be a writer instead of a performer?
Yeah, I mean, I always got to do both. I always got to write and perform. I don't, you know, when I write, I don't typically take writing credits and that sort of stuff. I think actors get enough slaps in the back that you don't need to start, you know, hogging all that stuff. But I love the collaboration of it. I love the collaboration of writing and working on a sitcom, which was my first big job in Los Angeles, was a sitcom. It was like the dream come true. It was, you know, live audience. So I was getting that kind of Groundlings experience that I was looking for, but it was also, you know, like a real paying television show.
And this was two guys, a girl, and a pizza
place? Guys, a girl, and a pizza place, yeah.
And they lost the pizza place.
They ended up
right?
losing the pizza place at some point, yeah. But it was a great group of people. And honestly, I loved every single member of that cast and crew. And I'm still in touch with them all. And it was great because I would do the warm-up sometimes for the audience.
I heard
it was a lot of fun. It was just a fun atmosphere, you know. I looked at my contemporaries who are working on these hour-long shows where they would be working these 16-hour days, or, you know, sometimes they're Fridays, they called Fratter days because they go all the way right into Saturday morning. Right. But so the sitcom life was just the greatest. I would work for 6 months or 7 months of the year shooting the shows, mm-hmm. and then I would take the whatever, you know, I made on the show, and I would just go wander the world for the remaining 6 months. I didn't have that, like, sort of ambition at that point, like, yeah. Okay, well, as soon as the show's done, I gotta go get a movie.
Go get it, right, no, right.
I didn't care, I just like to go travel.
And this went on for a few years, right? So it started in 98, and then, or 97, I think you got the part, and then, because the first big movie, I think the place where maybe you crossed most people's radar would have been Van Wilder.
Yeah, Van Wilder, yeah.
2002.
Yeah.
To remind anyone who either, or to tell anyone who might not have seen it, this is a... It's been described as a gross-out comedy. I think it's more than that, but that's one way. On the one hand, it put you sort of more on the map. On the other hand, I've read that you didn't want to even hear the words Van Wilder for a while afterwards. Is that fair to say?
No, I wouldn't say that. I was always grateful for that opportunity, but it was the National Lampoon brand, which is something I grew up with and loved. Mm-hmm. You know, and if you watch the movie, I'm really just doing the best Chevy Chase impression I can do. You know, he was a big influence on me when I was a kid, and I watched all his films, and, you know, I worshipped Fletch as a 15-year-old kid. But it was great. But it was always there was a weird kind of contradiction there, because, like, the full title of the movie is Van Wilder Party Liaison. So, like, I would go out to a bar or a restaurant, and when people would see me, they'd be like, let's line up your shots, it's time to get wasted, you know. And I would see these guys coming up to me who had so much to drink they were legally boneless, and I wasn't that guy. So it was always this weird kind of thing. And then I remember they wanted to do a I think they ended up doing two sequels, both without me. Yeah, it was one of those movies. I had a couple of those movies in my career. I think that one, and I would say Waiting and mm-hmm. Just Friends, mm-hmm. were all movies that didn't, like, really hit in the box office, didn't really resonate with critics, but it had this, like, weird, long cult life afterwards that people found the movie and sort of memorized it, drinking games to it, and, you know, so.
Quote it back to you endlessly, yeah, probably.
Yeah, it was cool. Yeah.
So the beginning of, I guess, a different thread of your career would have been, I think, Blade Trinity. You were playing this undead detective, Hannibal King, and this was sort of the first...
How dumb is showbiz? Just listen to you, like, you play an undead detective, and you're just like, oh my God, have real jobs.
You know what, people, yeah. But you bring a lot of happiness,
yeah,
so...
I guess, yeah.
But the first sort of step into the world of, I guess, comic book superhero type movies, were those things that you had personally enjoyed growing up?
Yeah, I mean, I, like everyone, I liked the whole sort of, you know, the superhero genre was this cyclical thing. It would come around and it would sort of vanish for a while. So I loved growing up. I loved watching the original Batman movies. And, you know, as a kid, I watched the Adam West version of the Batman show, and I loved it. But no, I mean, at that point, you know, the Blade movie was just a job. It was a job I enjoyed and had a lot of fun doing. And
got ripped for it, right? That was the first time you really had to physically get in shape for a...
Yeah, I remember David Goyer, who's a name that a lot of comic book junkies will know, but he was the director and the writer of it, and he said, you know, you got to get pumped up for this. And I was like, oh, well, what does that mean? And so I just started doing it. But I've always been that guy. Like, I have no sort of ability to do things with moderation.
Right.
So I went all in. And
25 pounds of muscle.
Yeah, it was fun. It all just vanished about 3 months after I finished shooting, but it was cool. Yeah.
And you did get to display some of your improv skills on that. I am told that you are fully responsible for, quote, you cock-juggling thunder cunt, close quote.
Well,
so that was...
Yeah, I don't know if I can take full responsibility for that, but, given the circumstances.
Right.
yeah.
But the next year, so this is how far back we're going, 2005 was, from what I understand, the beginning of the whole relationship with Deadpool. And maybe you can share how it first crossed your radar and what the holdup was.
Oh, God. Well, it started actually on Blade. I was sent the comic books by an executive who had control of at that point, of the Deadpool rights. And I opened a comic book, and there it was. And one of the first things I saw on the panel was just the most shocking thing you could imagine seeing, which was my own name was in the comic book. There was a moment where somebody asked Deadpool what he looks like under the mask, and he says, I look like a cross between Sharpay and Ryan Reynolds. And I just thought, this is odd. This is like some sort of weird star-crossed moment. And kept plowing through them and just really saw an opportunity for something that was completely different. You know, this guy operates in ways that really I felt meshed really well with both the things that I appreciate and my sensibilities, mm-hmm. And just the meta aspect, the fourth wall breaking, the self-awareness, the filtering his pain through this prism of humor. And like, I just loved it. You know, I just thought there's just sort of like the sky was the limit for a character like this. And I remember having a meeting with, at the time, Avi Arad, mm-hmm. who I think owned and ran Marvel. Mm-hmm. This is before it was all sold off. This is a real history lesson here.
No, it's good.
With Avi Arad and Stan Lee, and sitting in an office with these two guys talking about how we can get a Deadpool movie made. And at that point, David Goyer even signed on to shepherd the project, and then had a few other people. And it was just this rock I kept rolling up a hill that kept coming back down on top of me. It just never could get the traction that I thought it
merited.
What
do you think was the issue?
It's so weird, you know? I think it's just a strange property for people to really... There's something slightly abstract about it, if you think about it. It's not like a safe bet, you know? Mm-hmm. And it's also not a cheap bet either.
Right.
I mean, granted, we ended up shooting the Deadpool movie on a shoestring budget as far as superhero mm-hmm. movies are concerned, but I think people were a little wary of it, you know? Also, anytime you put the Marvel logo up and you're doing a Marvel character, you think, like, if it doesn't work, you've sort of burned it.
Right.
And you really got to wait a number of years before you can reinvent it. So I think there was a lot of trepidation. And that same sentiment sort of traveled all the way into the upper echelons of Fox when we finally got the project over there and tried to get it going. So it was. Yeah.
So then while the holdup was taking form, and it was obviously over a decade of waiting around but just trying to get it off the ground. In the meantime, I want to ask you about some of the other movies you did. I think it's interesting, the movie, just one in particular, The Nines, in which you played three different characters, a game designer, TV producer, and a star, made for less than $1 million. And yet it seems like it would have been an interesting acting challenge. And you've said before that, quote, that was the birth of my own ambition, close quote.
Yeah, I really thought it was, I guess it's a little irresponsible to say it was the birth of my ambition, but it was, God, I say stupid things sometimes when you read them back to me. It really changed my idea of film. I really suddenly saw film as this like limitless medium, like this place that you could really die and be reborn over and over again and reinvent yourself and do all kinds of fun things. And I loved that project. I loved working with John August, who's still a very close friend of mine, and just kind of opened my eyes to the idea that you can, you know, you don't have to be just the wacky neighbor on a sitcom, which is what my earlier ambitions were. You could kind of explore, you know, to the farthest ends of the showbiz universe, whatever it is that you want to explore. So.
Right. So that one was 2007. Then in 2009, you did one that I think is an amazing movie and underappreciated, and that's Adventureland, which was just a great ensemble movie, and you were excellent. And I just wonder if you have any thoughts about that, because it also was the beginning of a very big year for you. That one was at Sundance in 2009, so maybe just anything that stands out about that.
Adventureland was a lot of it. Greg Mottola is a brilliant, you know, brilliant director, and what a cast. I mean, Jesse Eisenberg, you have Kristen Stewart, Bill Hader, Kristen Wiig, you know, it was just an incredible group of people and a beautiful story and a small movie and one that I really appreciated being a part of. I loved it. Yeah. But that was a big year.
Well, because then the next thing would have been, I think, in May of that same year, you do X-Men Origins Wolverine, where for the first time you're playing this guy who becomes Deadpool, right?
Yeah.
And how did that come up? I mean, that's kind of weird. You were still trying to get an actual movie about Deadpool.
I was desperately trying to get a movie about Deadpool made, and Fox controlled the rights, and we sort of went back and forth on these ideas of making a Deadpool movie, and in the end, they just said, look, we're going to put Deadpool in Wolverine. I thought, great.
Yeah.
Like, I, you know, knowing some of the canon of Deadpool, I thought, okay, so Deadpool's going up against Wolverine, but that wasn't the case at all. It was a be careful what you wish for situation. And, you know, in the marketing and certainly in the actual body of the real Deadpool movie, we make fun of the studio for this sort of thing. But at the time, if you actually were to break it down and look back at it, it was an against all odds situation. I mean, there was a writer's strike on. There was nothing happening. I mean, Deadpool's scenes in that movie, I remember in the script, just said Deadpool shows up, talks really fast, says funny things.
And like, so you were literally having to come up with this, right?
Yeah, I just wrote my own lines, which was fun and something that, you know, I like doing, and that was great. But then it took this really weird narrative turn in the middle of the movie, which was that Deadpool, somebody, and I would assume it had to be an executive because there were no writers available at the time. So an executive decided, let's sew his mouth shut
and
do the one thing that sort of counteracts every fiber of Deadpool's real being. So It was a little devastating, honestly. Like, it was really sad. I don't even play that part of the movie as much as people think. I'm only in a couple of shots. It's a wonderful, actually a wonderful performer named Scott Adkins, who does the heavy lifting of the Deadpool in that movie.
But coming out of that one, did you think, shit, that was my stab at Deadpool? Or did you think...
I was fucking depressed and bummed out. And, you know, I just, because it was sort of like, it was a situation of like, yeah, you can play Deadpool and Wolverine and hopefully we could, you know, launch a real full Deadpool
or whatever,
canon on its own, or we can hire someone else. You know, and I understand their business model and why they have to do that, but it was just like a sort of, it was tough, you know? Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, well, maybe I can make Wade Wilson, that part of it, sound as much like Deadpool as possible, and I tried, and you know, but you know, it's the best laid plans, you know. That was a tough one. So that one hurt a little bit, but it also opened up a lot of doors for me too, you know. I've had what I think is a lifelong friendship with Hugh Jackman since then, because you're just not going to find a classier, kinder, better performer anywhere, you know. So it was great getting to spend that time with him.
And then later that summer, just a month or two later, was The Proposal, which I think was the one of the most successful rom-coms that has come along this century, and you have great comedic and romantic chemistry with Sandra Bullock, who I think you've become good friends with. And just wonder, you know, did you guys anticipate? I know this was sort of her genre as well up before that, but could you guys have imagined that it would have done as well as it did?
No, but I had known her for 10 years before we shot that. So we had a chemistry already kind of in place, which was nice. That's sort of a bit of a cheat sheet. But I think it's also, you know, the movie's great. People love the chemistry. They love the story. They love the movie in general. But I also think it's timing. It came around right when there was a huge drought of romantic comedies. There hadn't been one in years. So it was sort of a perfect movie at the perfect time. And it really worked. I certainly didn't see it coming. And I don't know if Sandy did. I mean, she's used to a much higher level of success than I certainly am. So I think she was, maybe she did see it coming. I don't know.
How, after that, though, did you find, you know, your own life and career opportunities changing? I think it was right after that that you had your People's Sexiest Man Alive and some of this stuff. I know you'd been on the list before, but now you're number one. All these different things.
Sure.
Did you feel that your options and star power or whatever in Hollywood were markedly different after that?
A little bit. I mean, anytime you have a movie that has huge box office rewards, you certainly are availed to a lot of different material, a lot of different things. But, you know, it sort of led to a bunch of other things, which was fantastic. But it was... Yeah, it felt like a bit of a different era, you know? But you always, I don't know if anyone feels like it's, maybe some guys do, I don't know, I feel like kind of entitled with it, like, yeah, of course, this is like how it's supposed to be. And I never really was comfortable with that. So it's always kind of, all of it was kind of a shock, you know?
Another one that I think was in the works probably before that one even became a big hit, but which I thought you, one of the best performances I've seen you give was as this truck driver contractor in Iraq who gets trapped, basically kidnapped and buried alive in the movie Buried a year later, 2010. And I just thought, you know, this is like a Hitchcockian challenge. Yeah. That must have been very different than anything you've ever had to do.
Oh man, that's one of my favorite movies I've ever done. I mean, if you look at the log line, you just think, no.
How do you do a movie?
That's just stupid. Then why would you do that? But it was such a beautiful experience and a really beautiful film. And Rodrigo Cortez, who's the director, is just a obsessive Alfred Hitchcock fan. You know, you look at a lot of Alfred Hitchcock did a lot of isolation type films, you know, even Rope is an isolation type film, and Lifeboat certainly is one. And so it's creating a universe with very little. And that's what he did. And it was, you know, he built a whole world inside this tiny little wooden box for this guy. And I loved it because I learned so much in that process, because the character that's in the coffin is actually kind of an asshole. And I learned that it's much more interesting to watch somebody that you automatically have empathy for, no matter who they are, because they're in a situation that's unimaginable and horrible. So we really liked exploiting that idea that, like, he's not somebody you would necessarily want to have a beer with if he gets out of this coffin, but you want him desperately to get out of this coffin.
Yeah.
So it was fun telling stories in that kind of way, filtering it through that prism. And that movie really is one of my all-time favorites.
It's fantastic. Yeah. I keep trying to remember where I saw it, if it was maybe Tribeca Film Festival
Sundance. It did the rounds, did all the sort of European rounds.
People should track it down. I don't know if it's Netflix or whatever. But so the first one, though, that I would think was maybe in some ways the result of The Proposal success would have been The Green Lantern.
Yep.
and with Deadpool, meanwhile, still not going anywhere, that comes along and you did it. And I just wonder, how it arose, but also did you pursue it because you assumed that Deadpool was dead? I would assume that Marvel has probably not. It's weird to jump between the two, Marvel and DC.
You have to kind of look at the Deadpool journey as though you're using the framework of a standard romantic comedy, which is that guy gets girl, guy falls in love with girl, guy loses girl, guy makes public declaration of love for girl. Right. Except this one didn't have a happy ending at the time. Right. So what really went down, and it's kind of wild to think back now, but I remember I was auditioning for Green Lantern. And they were doing these really extensive screen tests, and they were screen testing a bunch of other guys that were my peers that were, I thought, just incredible, like unbelievable talents. And I thought, I don't know if I'm going to get this. And then I made it through another screen test and another one. And then I thought, oh my God, I think I might actually get this. So I quickly called the executive I knew at Fox who had Deadpool. And I said, look, I am standing at the altar right now, about to say I do to someone else. If I will walk away from this, if you think that you just even think that you will make a Deadpool movie, that you can make a Deadpool movie with me. And he said, unfortunately, no, I don't think that's going to happen. So I went off and did Green Lantern. And then what was weird, the weird sort of plot twist, is that there was somehow, some way, Deadpool got reinvigorated at Fox. So
While this was happening.
So I ended up flying back from New Orleans where we were shooting Green Lantern and meeting a whole bunch of writers and directors, and then finally met this pair of writers named Rhett Reese and Paul Wernick. And this is in 2009, I think. And we just immediately hit it off. And we've all been super great friends ever since. And immediately hit it off. And what a lot of people don't know is they flew to New Orleans. We spent some time in New Orleans. While I was shooting Green Lantern, we were actually all together writing Deadpool.
Oh my gosh.
In the hopes that somehow, some way,
it would come back to life.
Yeah. And I knew the odds were against us because I thought, wow, if Green Lantern is a huge hit, they're never gonna accept me as both.
Right, two
and
franchises.
If Green Lantern is a huge failure, which it ended up being, they're never going to hire me for either. So it really was a strange journey. It was like just to think that we were breaking the story of Deadpool, the original Deadpool movie, on basically
another
kind of in a house
companies.
That was being paid for by Green Lantern's dime was a weird situation. So.
Why do you think Green Lantern didn't pan out better?
Well, I've spoken about this before, and it certainly is no reflection on how hard everybody worked on the movie. I mean, nobody sets out to make a movie that doesn't work. But, I think it fell prey to some of the classic studio tropes, which is that, you go for a poster first, a release date second, or vice versa, and script last.
Right.
And it just never really understood what it was. It never really, there was no kind of way into it where you think, okay, this is what it is. This is what it is in tone and character. And I never... And maybe that's my fault too. It probably is. I just never quite kind of got the. I never had that thing to grab onto where I was like, okay, this is this guy and this is his journey and this is what he wants.
Right.
And you always have to ask yourself, what does your protagonist want? And in that movie, we didn't really have a clear idea of that.
I guess once the wheels are already in motion, it's hard to say stop and let's
clarify. And the only way you kind of could sort of course correct is to try to just spend more money, and that was the situation that was happening there. And I remember thinking I wish they would just take whatever money that they're firing into so many of these albeit worthwhile effects set pieces, and just really just get some great writers here, and let's see how we can make this something smaller but more special. And it didn't happen, but it's also it's not that's how this works. This business works. These are not real problems. These are uptown problems.
Well, it was a learning experience.
Yeah, it was a huge learning experience. And
I guess the upside was you did meet your future wife. Was it on that movie?
We were buddies for another 2 or 3 years after that, and that's when we ended up getting together much later.
So like nothing many,
many
on
years
the
later.
Set.
No.
That's always dangerous.
No, yeah, that's always dangerous. No. That's not something you ever want to do.
Right. When you have a movie like that performs disappointingly, or we can talk about this now because you've certainly come through the other side, but I mean,
talked about it when I didn't come through the other side. Right. So I'm all right talking about
no,
it.
No, well, just because you had a little period there where it was Green Lantern, Change Up, RIPD, where it must have felt like you're just getting punched left and right, right?
Yeah, a little bit, but you do, but you're also sort of, you want to, once you're a working actor, you like staying a working actor, So it was an odd series. One of those movies was Safe House, which actually really worked. but I think it was a little overshadowed by the other ones that didn't. So it was a rough go, but at the same time, I look back at it, I was never like sitting around going, you know, woe is me, my life sucks. Right. You go, I'm working. I like very lucky to have had those opportunities, even though they didn't pan out the way, you know, anyone wanted.
So. But there was an interesting decision that you made, which I think makes a lot of sense, and it seems to have paid off, which seems like it would have been right around the period of that when those movies were coming out. So I would guess like late 2013, it looks like, where you basically said, let's change up the team around me, which you'd had for a long time, right?
Yeah, and
what goes into that? And do you really think that is largely responsible for the amazing run that's happened since?
I think, you know, I think you can certainly apply some credit to that. It's working with a team that, you know, you believe in and they believe in you. And, you know, that's always a huge bonus and it helps. But, you know, I think it was a mixture of many things. You know, one of the things that was a part of that situation was just dumb fucking luck. You know, it was that, you know, we'd had this test footage for Deadpool that was sitting around right around that time. And shortly thereafter, that footage ends up on the internet. And
you wouldn't have any idea how that happened, would you?
I have no idea how that happened. You know, I don't know. I don't even have a send button on my computer. It's, so that, you know, it was a combination of things.
Because, that was July 2014. It leaks online. People love it. Now, where did that test footage was taken when? And for what reason?
Let's go through the timeline. 2009, we're breaking story. Me, Rhett, and Paul, we're spending a lot of time on the script. We finally have a draft of the script. That script is going around. We're meeting a number of different directors. A couple directors actually had signed on. And then, you know, it didn't ended up not working out for a number of different reasons. And then around 2000, and I want to say 11, Tim Miller signed on. And he just really genuinely had a great and beautiful passion for Deadpool. And I think he, for till the day he dies, he will. He just really got it and understood it. And so Tim basically thought, okay, I'm a visual effects guy. I have a visual effects studio. And I guess he convinced the studio to say, hey, let's throw a little bit of money into this. Just a little bit, you know, tiny, tiny bit of money to just give you a little 1.5 minute sort of sequence.
Like Deadpool.
So we all furiously got to sort of working on what that might be and writing it out and making sure it was the right thing and just something that really caught the tone of it. And then it just sat on the shelf for years. I don't know how that happened. I would revisit it every like 2 months, just sort of wistfully, like some lover scorn, looking and going like, how do they not like this?
Right.
This is really good. I think this is fun. And then, you know, it just goes to show that nobody knows anything. Suddenly that's on the internet and then boom, it's suddenly on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook, just there suddenly become your 500-pound lawyers arguing on your behalf. And, you know, the next thing you know, they've greenlit the movies.
And in the meantime, just to talk about the movies that came out after the footage leak, but before Deadpool came out, some of your strongest work in low budget movies, we've got The Voices in 2014, The Captive for Adam McGoyan in 2014, Woman in Gold opposite Helen Mirren in 2014, Mississippi Grind in 2015 for Ryan Fleck and Anna Boden, who people, you know, art house people love. And I guess, did it feel like you were just reinvigorated in some way, or it just worked out that way?
Well, there were all scripts I loved and really fell in love with, particularly The Voices and Mississippi Grind are two that I just thought were so special. And I thought, I, you don't want to bemoan anything because they're all lucky to be working, but man, that Mississippi Grind should have got a little more traction.
Totally. It was amazing.
Such a well-crafted movie, and all that credit goes to Ryan and Anna.
You and Mendelsohn have awesome chemistry, too.
I loved working with Ben Mendelsohn. I never wanted that to end. And it was just one of those beautiful jobs where you're spending all day and night with each other, and there's never a moment where you'd want to be anywhere else. And you could see it on screen, you know. It's a movie that's a love story between two guys who are just basically unlucky in life.
That's great. I think he's so talented
as
well.
I do too.
I heard with Woman in Gold, just one little follow up here. Harvey did not love you wearing glasses in the movie.
No, he didn't like me wearing glasses. Oh, there's a couple things that he did. I don't think he loved that I was wearing glasses, and I don't think I think he always felt like there's something off. I still don't think he knows that I'm actually wearing false teeth.
Were you?
Yeah, they're very subtle, but they're just enough to kind of make my teeth look a little screwy. Harvey's been one of my all-time favorite experiences, just to know him and to be around him and to watch him sort of operate in this business, crazy business. He's so old-fashioned in the best way.
Yeah, you know? Totally. So now as Deadpool's starts finally coming together, were you being at all pressured to do it as a PG-13 as opposed to an R?
That had happened many years before. We had done several iterations of the script in which we toned it all down. And it was just, that was also a little heartbreaking, you know. It just felt like we always intended the movie to be small in scale so we could be, you know, so we could have a rated R or an R rating. So it was just, yeah, it was one of those things where we have, their scripts still exist. I mean, I have them on my computer. They're fine. They're not bad scripts. They're still very fun. I think the movie still would have been very successful. Mm-hmm. It just wouldn't have had that real bite that it needed, that the R rating gave us. So yeah, but there was a lot of talk about that. But once that test footage leaked and once the studio sort of got wind of the appetite of this character for the fans, they gave us a green light. But they gave us a green light with, you know, again, the absolute bare bones minimum.
$58 million for a superhero movie is not, or a comic book movie is not a lot.
No.
And so then the first subsequent audience exposure to the movie would have been at Comic-Con?
Yeah, that was Comic-Con was the first time we put it in front
and
of an audience.
And what was that like? Because they went nuts.
Well, it's weird because if you're me in that situation, I'm so close to it for so many years. I mean, at that point, it's nearly 10 years. And I'm just, it's like, so I have no objectivity anymore. And, you know, we all collectively sat in that edit room for eons and you know, really just like had spent days just discussing like, changing two frames of certain shots. So there was
you're a producer on it as well.
I am a producer on it as well. Yeah. So I, you know, it was strange to walk in that audience and think and have no idea what the reaction would be. Whereas some of the other people that were on in the know and had seen the footage from the studio, they were very bullish and I didn't know what to make of that. So when that audience went
ballistic
and then also like screaming for us to play it one more time was one of the strange. It was actually Hugh Jackman a lot of people don't know, is the reason they played it one more time.
Really?
Because the stage manager said, we don't have time to play it one more time. We're not going to play it one more time. And Hugh was coming on next for the X-Men panel, and he was the guy who said, mate, play it one more time.
That's great.
Play it one more time now. And off we went. They played it one more time. It was a pretty cool, it was a great moment. It was a really great moment. And you know, I was fixated on like really stupid things. Like, you know, we didn't get the song we wanted for the Hollaback Girl was a song that we had in the script forever.
Right.
And we couldn't afford it. So we ended up getting a song that plays so much better, actually, ironically, which was Shoop, which was just this beautiful, perfect song by Salt-N-Pepa. But I was still worried if it would, because I was so used to it at that point of Hollaback Girl playing in that exact same spot. And I saw every head in Comic-Con bopping up and down when the song played. I was like, oh, this is working.
Right.
Yeah.
So when the film itself eventually in its entirety gets released, had again, $58 million budget, $132 million opening weekend.
Yep.
It's $363 million domestically in the end and $783 worldwide. That's pretty astounding. And I just wonder if you can step outside of it for a second and just sort of try to give your objective analysis. What were people hungry for that you guys provided? Why did it do so well?
I think the movie is unusual. The movie's groundbreaking in a lot of ways. It usurps certain tropes in the superhero genre that were well ready to be usurped. Mm-hmm. And again, timing. Mm-hmm. You know, it was just, we're kind of at peak superhero in terms of tone and it just offered something completely different with that respect. And it also had just an unabashed commitment to its R rating.
Yeah.
And, you know, as I look back again, and I sort of can look sort of in hindsight, obviously it's 2020, but mm-hmm. I could look back and go, okay, well, why did it work? It knew what it was, you know, and I always knew what it mm-hmm. was. I knew exactly mm-hmm. how to play this guy. I felt in some weird way, not to sound like too kind of over the top with it or esoteric, but I felt like in a weird way, I was like born to play this guy. I could really understood him. And it just kind of popped, you know? It's just one of those things. And it also had a weird release date for it to do money like that. It was February. It was Valentine's Day weekend. It was unusual in a lot of ways. It changed things for a lot of studios, too. You know, suddenly the calendars are all new these days. You know, there's no sort of bad month or bad date. So.
And, I mean, if anyone hasn't yet seen it, we can remind them that, or, you know, tease without spoiling anything that from these tongue-in-cheek opening credits to breaking the fourth wall to references even to your own career and mm-hmm. things like the Green Lantern and I mean it's just really not what people are used to. And you said, quote, I've never done a job where I gave my last drop of blood and this was that. And so you just personally, over those 11, 12 years, I guess 11 years, never really doubted that it would work.
Yeah, I never doubted that it would work as a character and a concept. Right. I did no idea that it would be successful fiscal sense, in a box office sense. And it's in a certain way that I didn't really care about that. Mm-hmm. And that, I think that that was a huge wake-up call to me as well, is that when you do a film or do something, it's, and you're so passionate about it and you love it. So I mean, I genuinely have the biggest cartoon hearts that come out of my eyes when I get to think about playing this guy. And when you love it like that, you sort of abandon the idea that you're invested in its outcome. So it came from this place of love, and it was just, it worked. And so to see it rewarded in that way, or just, you know, forget about the box office aspect, just the fact that people all around the world embrace this character and love the character. Yeah. That was a very, very cool pinch me moment that really never happens.
So successful not only at the box office, but let's just list a few things that have happened in the last month or so.
Yeah.
You got your star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame, which I don't think is unrelated to the success of this movie.
No, not.
You got a special Critics' Choice Award for Entertainer of the Year. Yeah. You got a Best Actor in a Musical or Comedy Golden Globe nomination. And then the film got a Best Picture Musical or Comedy Golden Globe nomination. Plus, and this is where a lot of people were kind of taken aback because it's just so unusual for this genre of a movie, PGA, WGA, and now DGA nominations, and we'll see what happens on January 24th with the Oscar nominations. But what do you make of that aspect of it? And I guess, what would you say if there's any Academy members listening to this? Here's your chance.
Well, you know, I think the reason that the Academy expanded its the number of Best Picture films that could be submitted is indicative of situations maybe like this. Mm-hmm. And you know, you have a character that has really captured the sort of the popular vote, if you want to say. And it's, you know, I think, and I don't know, but I would suspect that some of the reasons that we've garnered all this awards attention that we had no, literally, and this is not false modesty, we had no idea we would ever get anything beyond a MTV Movie Award Best Kiss nomination. But the fact that it's, you know, our peers, the WGA and the PGA and, you know, the Critics' Choice and all these things, it's been incredible. But I think they're also attracted to the story behind the story, which is that, you know, this was a labor of love that spans well over a decade. Yeah. And you know, it's a kind of a, you know, it's hard to say this about a big studio film, you know, because it is, when with respect to when you compare it to some of the smaller films that are being in contention, but it is a bit of a Cinderella story in that sense. So, you
it's
know,
like Rock, it's one of these stories where you just, it is the lore of the behind the movie is known to everybody as well. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. And I think if it does end up in that category, I think that's kind of a cool moment for not just us, but for everybody, for the people that went to see the movie, the people that made the movie, the studio, I think even the Academy, I think it's kind of a neat moment to, you know, I don't think any superhero film has ever really broken that glass ceiling. So
not
it'd be
quite
nice
that.
To see one like Deadpool do it. But I can certainly promise one fucking crazy reaction video online of in the suit, in the Deadpool suit, guaranteed. Yeah, it's gonna, we'll see.
That's awesome. Well, so just as a final question, I know you're, I think now at work on Deadpool 2. I don't know if that's even the title, but is that?
I am on work at this, on the sequel to Deadpool, which I also don't know what the
title
is.
Okay, all right.
Yeah,
so that's in motion. Yeah, but like, you know, at this very momentous moment in your career, and we've been through it all just now, just talking about the ups and downs, it's hard to imagine it gets much more up than this. What's your evaluation of the big picture and what's left to do? Is there a specific goal or thing that you really want to capitalize on at this point?
You know, I don't know. It's one thing about Deadpool and that character. It's quite literally, excluding the time I spent with my family and my daughters, it swallowed my life whole. So it's when I say it's a full-time job, that's kind of the understatement of the year. It's something that I've quite literally never stopped working on since I stepped off set a year and a half ago.
Because of promotional things?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the few times I've ever seen where the promotional aspects of the film, the marketing, was a direct extension of the movie itself. So, you know, early on, we all sort of felt like, working with Mark Weinstock and the gang at Fox in marketing, I really felt like we had to create content of Deadpool that is not culled directly from the film. So you're really doing the mission was to introduce this character to audiences where we're not having to kind of exploit some of the stuff, the special stuff that's in the film. So if we could find a way to do that and do it in a way that really caught those audiences, like the video game playing audience, you know, the ones that don't necessarily always go to the films anymore, mm-hmm. go see movies anymore. So we really got to pierce through that. And then from that point of like where the marketing ended to has just been developing the second yeah. movie. And it's just a, sort of a, you know, it's every single day, all day. And it's been one of the great pleasures of my life, but it's also not without its challenges, right. that's for sure. So, yeah.
Well, congratulations. Yeah. And thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you for having me. Thank awesome. You for having me. Yeah.